Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
It's 3 a.m. in the Bronx, New York. I'm on the corner of 187th and Belmont Avenue. This was my neighborhood. This is a Bronx tale.
You know, I could just let that music play forever because I love the music of this show, A Bronx Tale. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. We're Behind the Curtain. I'm Paul Lisnick, and I'm just so excited. Joining me to talk about The Bronx Tale is the guy that created it and who I saw perform in it on Broadway, Chaz Palminteri. It is playing at the James Nederlander Theater here in Chicago from March 12th. Through the 24th, not all that long, so you do not want to wait to get tickets. But the story behind this is amazing. Let me tell you a little bit about Chaz as we get to talk. He performed this actually as a one-man show. That was back in 1989, went off Broadway. Then he went on to write the screenplay. You've probably seen the movie of A Bronx Tale, starring also Robert De Niro. Unbelievable. Then it became a musical, but we'll talk about that together. Chaz has been in more than 55 movies, an actor, a writer, a director, The Usual Suspects, Bullets Over Broadway. If I don't get to it, I'm never going to get to talk to him because his credentials go on forever. But I will mention he was a regular in Modern Family and directed an episode of one of my favorite shows, Oz, on HBO. I'm going to get those in there. Chaz, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, it's good to be here, Paul. Thank you.
Oh, so fantastic. I loved Bronx Tale. Saw it, as I said, saw it with you in it, in the musical, which was an incredible treat. Because you only
Thank
did it for
you.
Like 2 months, right?
I did it for about 4 months, yes. 4 months. I was... You know, it was just impossible for me to do, but Nick Cordero, who was nominated for a Tony for Bullets Over Broadway, he was the lead in it from the very beginning, but then he had to go off to do a movie, and then I stepped in for the last 4 months, and 3 or 4 months, and I did the musical. You know, I always wanted it to be done with someone else because I was just so busy doing a series, and I'm doing another film, so it was just hard for me, but I made it my business. After Nick left, because he had to go, I stepped in and I did it, and it was just great. I really enjoyed it. It was wonderful.
Well, you were fantastic. And what people know you wrote it, and people may understand that this is kind of your life, but what is actually true is this really is your life. I mean,
it is.
These characters, your real name is Calogero. That is your real name.
My real name is Calogero Lorenzo Palminteri. That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Yes. And my father was a bus driver. My mom, Lou Rosina. I had a relationship with a black girl when I was 17. And, you know, it's exactly the way the killing you saw in the movie, or if you saw the musical or the one-man show, it's exactly the way it happened. I was sitting on a stoop. I saw these cars park trying to get into the spot. I thought they were fighting over a parking space, and one of them got out, and he killed him right in front of me. Then the other guy got out. I mean, he hit him with a baseball bat, and he was bleeding. And then the wise guy came over and killed him to protect his friend.
And I know you were that was 1960. You were only 9 years old when that happened. And you know what? Just for folks who don't know A Bronx Tale, let's kind of pull back a little bit, because here we are, two guys who, you know, the show, you know, every word of it, and I just know it well.
Sure.
For folks who have never seen the show or aren't familiar, just kind of give us the plot of this show, which is your life.
Well, basically what happened was I was 9, I was almost 10, and I was sitting on my stoop, and I saw these two guys fighting over a parking space, and one guy got out with a baseball bat, and he smashed the window of the other guy, trying to sneak in behind him, and, you know, the bat went through the window into the guy's head, and the guy got out of the car, and the guy went to hit him again with the bat. I thought he was going to kill him, and this gangster, Sonny, came over, and it was his friend who got hit with the bat, and he shot the man right in the face, and the guy fell down, and then everybody ran. The cops came. My father ran down, grabbed me by my arm, and dragged me upstairs. And then the cops came up, and they wanted me to witness. You know, they wanted me to say who, you know, people were saying the kid was on the stoop. The kid was on the stoop. And I said, I didn't see anything. You know, the cops knew I did, but I said, look, I don't. And my father was like, hey, he doesn't know nothing.
Yeah.
And that was it, you know. And then the next day, when I saw the guy, you know, he just kind of like, smiled and looked at me, and gave me a look, and then each day I would see him, and it was one of those looks, like, I know that you know that I know, you know, and then I want to go get, I made cappuccino for them in the bar. I said, hey, come on, make some cappuccino for us. I'll teach you how to make it, and he was a great guy, you know, and I just started hanging out with him. But the thing that makes it different than a lot of the other things, it's a family movie, because he told me the same things that my father did. Stay in school, go to college, make something out of yourself, get out of the neighborhood. And that's what makes the Bronx Tale different. He said the same exact words as my father did, only my father was threatened because of who he was, and he thought I would be influenced by who he was.
What you said was so critical. It's fair enough. People, I think when they think about this, they see it as a gangster story. I don't. I see it as a family story.
No, it's not. It's a family story. It's about the father and the son and the mother. It's when the father said, the saddest thing in life is wasted talent. Yeah. It doesn't take much strength to pull a trigger. Get up in the morning and go to work for a living, you see. That's what the play is about. That's what the movie's about, and the musical.
In the real world, by the way, because I know that story about your dad saying that, your dad also said to you, don't waste your life, or promise me,
yes,
you won't waste your life. Was your dad around long enough to see this part of your success? I know he's gone now.
Oh, yeah. He saw all my success except the musical. He passed away a few years ago. He was 91, and my mother, she just missed, the musical was about to open, and she passed away. She was 97. But, you know, they saw all my success, so I'm not worried. They saw everything.
Perfect.
So I'm very good.
In this show, there's really kind of two father figures, which I think is a challenge for the audience, right? Because obviously Lorenzo,
yes,
is your real father, but there's,
yes,
Sonny. And we don't want to really like Sonny because we know he's kind of this gangster type, but the truth is we kind of do like Sonny. So,
yes.
Right? Talk to me about two father figures
influencing you. Sonny was a paradox. You know, he was a great guy. He really was. He was very funny and really smart. I mean, he read Machiavelli in prison when he was in jail, but he was also, you know, a bad guy. You know, he had a part of him that he was the boss, and if something went down the wrong way, you know, Sonny was not a man to mess with. But he was also this human guy. He was human. You know, he was very funny and a good guy, and he loved me. And my father was my hero. He was the greatest man in the world. And he was a wonderful man. But my father had some faults, too, you know. So, like, when I was dating a black girl, my father, he couldn't understand that.
Yeah.
Not that he was a racist. My father got along with, my father trained boxers and fighters. He loved the people on the bus. They were black and white on the bus. And everybody loved him. But when it came to his son being with a black girl, that bothered him.
But this was the 60s.
Sonny, it didn't bother.
It was the 60s.
It was the 60s. You know, he was a product of his time. You know, so it's not about black and white. It's about gray and gray.
There's in the musical, there's a challenge. I mean, your dad, Lorenzo, goes to, what I love about this, I got to tell you, Chaz, is that I we're not just talking about characters, sort of like, you know, like, how did you resolve? Mm-hmm. This really happened, which is amazing. So Lorenzo, your father, goes to see Sonny and basically kind of a keep your hands off my son. Did,
yes,
that all, that must have really happened then. And I'm wondering,
yes,
Sonny kind of deals with it in a, I don't know, positive way in the show, but what was the reality of it all? Was there, or did you ever worry about your father's,
yeah,
life?
Yeah, well, the reality was, when my father went to him, you see, Sonny, because he loved me and he was a good guy in the way, he knew my father was right. So he would always say, look, you know, he's your father. You know, I'm sorry if I'm interfering. You know, so my father, you know, that's why in the movie I wrote that in, when the wise guy says, you want me to take care of him? And Sonny says, no, leave him alone. Because Sonny knew that my father was right, you know. I'm his son.
Yeah.
But again, you can't disrespect Sonny. That's where my father would cross the line if he did that, you know. Sonny would say, get out of here, yeah, before I lose my temper.
So you grew up, I mean, Belmont Avenue, which is, we opened the podcast with that. The show opens with that. By the way, I live in the city off a street called Belmont Avenue, so they're around. But I know that that's real. And talk to me about the distinction. There's Belmont Avenue, but am I right? Belmont at some point becomes Webster Avenue, and that's where life,
yes,
changes.
That's where life changes. It was Belmont Avenue. If you went straight down, there was the L, and then there was Webster Avenue. And that's where it changed. Right under that L, boom, was the black neighborhood. So we would be, you know, we were on one side, they were on the other, and the L was in the middle, you know. And you couldn't go, once you walked under that L and went in that area, all bets were off.
Yeah.
And once they came in our area, all bets were off. But you see, my father didn't teach me to be a racist. My father was, I used to ride the bus with him, sit behind him, and he was so nice to everyone, black, white, anyone.
But you weren't, I can't look at you as naive. You kind of wonder when we watch the show whether your Galerdro is he naive at all? You're not. Do we make him a little naive?
No, he wasn't naive, but he didn't have the hate in him like some of these other guys did. Look, racism, Paul, is bred down from one generation to the next. Nobody's born a racist. You're taught to be a racist. Somebody has to fill you with that kind of hate, you know. And I wasn't filled with that. I was filled with love. You know, everybody's a good person. But I grew up in a neighborhood where some of it was racist.
Yeah.
You know, people sometimes in my neighborhood don't want to hear that, but it's the truth. And it wasn't racist to the folks that hated black people. It was more, we were poor, they were poor. This was our neighborhood, and they didn't want anybody else in it.
I got to ask you, came first? Critical question. Bronx Tale, the sandwich at Mike's Deli, or Bronx Tale, your show?
Bronx Tale came, you know, I mean.
So the sandwich got named after you. I want to know the sandwich got named after you at Mike, right?
I know. I mean, I used to go to Mike's Deli when I was a kid, and, you know, I put those in the play.
I know.
Excuse me. You know, Gino's pastry and Bugatti raviolis and
it's all there.
Idle Brothers. You know, they're all there. They're all there, you know?
I love it.
Look,
Go ahead.
Yeah, here's the thing about Bronx Tale, Paul. Everyone who sees it loves it. It was the only play on Broadway. I have to be honest. It was one of the three plays on Broadway that the guy told me in all the years of the theater that when people were leaving the theater, they would line up to buy tickets again. It was the most amazing thing. People would laugh. They would cry. They stand up and cheer at the end. I urge anybody, and I say this really, you know, humbly, it's just a great, great show. And if you have children like 10, 11, 12 years old, bring them because it's a great lesson. It's a cautionary tale. It turns kids where, you know, they won't waste their talent. It teaches them about drugs. It teaches them about a lot of things.
And so tolerance.
Exactly.
Yeah, on the musical point, I have to ask you, because Alan Menken, and by the way, Alan Menken is in concert here in Chicago on March 30th. In fact, I'm actually, I am the presenting sponsor of his show here at the Auditorium Theater. Hope you'll come in for it.
Yes.
But am I right, and hopefully he'll play Bronx Tale music, am I right that the original person you chatted with about music was Jimmy Webb?
Yes, that's correct. Yes. He was wonderful. Jimmy Webb's in the Rock and Roll Songwriters Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. He's a great writer. But you know what? And he wrote really some great songs, but they didn't fit the book. They didn't fit the book I wrote. It just wasn't a match, you know. And that happens. And it's not Jim's fault. It's not my fault. It just, you try to make it happen, and it didn't happen. So I said, look, the guy who really knows this, I mean, you know, it's not like I'm going out on the limb here. Alan Menken, 8-time Academy Award winner,
right.
You know. I said, but look, he knows fables. I said, he writes fables. I said, even though they're animation fables, they're fables. And Bronx Tale is a fable. I said, Alan Menken's the guy. I remember seeing, the thing, what was the one of the first things he did that was so brilliant.
Newsies, Aladdin, now you can go on and on. A lot of the Disney stuff.
No, it was very, his own.
Oh, Little Shop?
The original one, the very first one.
Could have been Little Shop. Little Shop of Horrors.
Little Shop. Oh, God. Little Shop of Horrors. And he had R&B in it. He had doo-wop. I said, That's it. That's the music from the time. And he came in and, he was Glenn Slater, wrote the lyrics, mm-hmm. 3-time Tony nominee, Alan Menken, 8-time Academy Award winner, Sergio Trillo, 3-time Tony nominee doing the choreography, he choreographed all the dances, Tommy Mottola, the legendary producer, produced it.
Jerry Zaks.
I wrote the book. Jerry Zaks, 4-time Tony winner, he directed the one-man show. He's co-directing with Robert De Niro, 2-time Academy Award winner. So there's so much talent involved in this show that I'm so excited, and I'm so excited for people to see it. I mean, like I always said, Alfred Hitchcock used to say there's only three things you could do to an audience, and if you do two out of three, you got a hit. He says you can make them laugh, you can make them cry, or you can scare them. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And in Bronx Tale, we make you laugh, we make you cry, and we scare you.
Yeah, you do. There are some moments, where we scare. Listen, I can't let you go without the Robert De Niro, because I'm sure people are listening going, Robert De Niro, what did he have to do with this? And, of course, he came and saw your one-man show, and then you find out he's hanging in your dressing room.
Yeah, I did. Once I did the one-man show, Paul, my career just exploded. Everybody wanted it. Every writer wanted to write it, the screenplay. Every director wanted to do it. Every producer, every studio head, every star wanted to play Sonny. I got offered $250,000 the first week it was open. And I said no, because they didn't want me. They wanted to put a star in their own. I was, you know, they said I was great, but I was nobody.
Yeah.
So I held out and went up to $500,000. Then after that, 2 weeks later, went up to $1 million. I had $200 in the bank, and I still said no. Then finally, a couple of weeks went by, I did the show, and I got upstage, and they said, hey, Robert De Niro is in your dressing room. He just saw the show. And I said, what? They said, yeah, he just saw the show. He's waiting for you in the dressing room. And I walked in the dressing room, and there was Bob, and he said, man, that's the greatest one-man show I ever saw. He goes, you did a movie on stage. This would make a great movie. And I said, yeah, that's what I want to do. And I said, but I got to play Sonny, Bob. He said, look, you should play Sonny, and you should write the screenplay because it's your life. I'll play your father, and I'll direct it, and we'll go partners. And if you shake my hand, that's the way it'll be. I shook his hand, and bam, that was the beginning of my career.
Wow. Just incredible. And he stayed with it all the way through. The decision to make it into a musical, the movie makes total sense to me. The one-man play makes total sense to me. Of course, now the musical makes total sense to me. But at the time, did you have a moment of just going, I don't know, this isn't a musical? Or?
No. I always felt it wouldn't make a great musical, and so did De Niro. He felt that way, too. But you know what? It always takes that one person to make it happen, and that was Tommy Mottola. You know, he put his money where his mouth is. He said, let's get this rolling. And that's what you need. You need that one person to say, let's go. And Tommy did that, and we got the Dodgers, who produced Jersey Boys and a whole bunch of other great things. And we made it happen, and we all made it happen. You know, so I'm very, very excited by it. And I'm just so excited that it's coming to Chicago, because I love Chicago. Chicago is just a great city.
Yeah, I hope we get you back here real soon, too. When they announced the new season, I saw Bronx Tale was coming. I just let the word out to everybody that you do not want to miss this show. I'll be there on opening night, of course.
Absolutely.
And
there might be a surprise. I don't want to say, but I'm working on a surprise on opening night. We'll see what happens.
If it means you're sitting next to me, I'm good with that.
Okay. We'll see. But I'm working on a surprise.
I love it. You got everybody excited about that. Chaz, so fantastic. You know, I want to go out by playing a song that I'm not going to lie to you. As I was preparing for this today, I was listening to the music again last night, and the song, one of the great ones, Good Luck Once You Hear It, Getting It Out of Your Head. I'll tell you, it kept me up all night just with that song in my head. And I do have to ask you one thing about it. We're going to have Nick Cordero sing it in just a moment. But there's scene, a picture, an image of your mother comes up, Rosina. And I found that interesting. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, you're a very smart guy, Paul, and I mean that. The reason why we put that in, I was talking to Alan about it. So he said to me, did Sonny know your mother one day while we were writing this together? You know, and I said, well, yeah. I said, Sonny asked my mother out. But my mother didn't go out with him because my grandfather, her father, obviously, said, no, you're not going out with him.
Because he's a mild
guy. He was like, oh, my God, that's great. Oh, we got to put that in. And I said, well, how are you going to put it in? And he said, well, and it was his idea. It was Alan Menken. That was his idea. And to be honest with you, I didn't know if it was going to work. I said, are you sure? He goes, yes, this will work. And I said, okay, let's give it a try. So when Sonny's thinking of when he could have married, and we just show Rosina up there like she could have been one of his great ones, you know, and he thinks about that.
So that is kind of what I thought was going on. I thought it was a really interesting take.
Yeah,
I
mean, and that's Alan Menken thought of that, and Alan Menken put that in, and that was all him.
Well, when I see Alan at the end of the month, I'm going to bring that up with him, too.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant, and that was his idea, and none of us really were sure if it was going to work, but Alan said, this is great. And he put it in, and you know what? Son of a gun, he was right.
Well, it did.
And let me tell you something about Alan Menken. I'm going to tell you. There's only two people in my whole life that I ever sat down to work with, that I ever saw that I could play piano and then just write a great song after one after another. And literally, Alan Menken would write a great song. We would try it, and it didn't work because it was a great song, but it didn't fit in the show. And he would go, okay, come back 45 minutes later with another great one. I mean, it was sick. it's like scary. He's so great that it's scary, Paul.
Yeah.
And the only other person like that was Billy Joel.
Yeah,
that I ever worked with.
Yeah.
The only two people I've ever seen that can write one great song after another are those two. I never seen anybody else.
Well, like I said, Alan's going to be here on March 30th in concert. You could be my guest for the show if you'd like to come in for it.
I'm going to try.
And that would be great.
Yeah.
Chaz, congratulations on this show. So glad it is touring the country. And I've seen some images of the traveling cast, and they are national tour cast, and they are amazing. The show, of course, you don't want to miss. It's playing from March 12th to the 24th at the Niederlander Theater. Tickets at BroadwayInChicago.com. Only March. There are no extensions. It's going on March 24th.
That's it.
You will regret if you didn't see A Bronx Tale, this masterwork of Chaz Palminteri. So, Chaz, if you don't mind, I want to go out playing the song that I can't get out of my head. I'm going to hear it one more time. One of the great ones, but it's sung by the great Nick Cordero. Here we go.
Yeah, this one could be one of the great ones. Yeah, this one could be one of the ones you want. Smiling at you like she knows you'll come through and makes you believe it somehow. Then, kid, you found one of those great ones. Go to her now. Go to her now. Kid, go to her now. Yeah, this one. One of those great ones.
Fine of all the dikes, we're dying. It seems that all of London's shaken to the core.
To lose one relative, one could certainly forgive.
But how can you excuse losing two,
or three,
or four,
or seven? Why of all the dikes, we're dying?
I've never seen such recklessness before.
It's unnerving.
It's not that they're not undeserving.
I never liked them much, I must confess.
In fairness, you must admit, at least, it's a shame about the priest.
I can't imagine missing someone less. But really, why are all the...
Yeah, such a classy, classy number, isn't it? Welcome to a discussion about the great show, A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. Joining me are the two stars of the show, Jeff Award winner, Matt Kroll, and we'll make you a Emmy Award winner. No, and also joining us,
yeah, right,
Andres Enriquez. Hey, who's going to question us? Who plays Monty Navarro? Matt Kroll. I don't even know who you play, Matt, because how many roles exactly do you play in this show?
Nine total.
There you go.
Yeah.
Only nine. Andres, you're hanging in
That's
there with
it.
One.
Yeah.
You got one in there.
Yeah, I got to push it too much.
Just one.
The show is wonderful. It has this flavor of being kind of an older show. It really isn't. Matt, let me come to you. Talk to me a little bit about what, for folks who haven't seen it, is playing at Porchlight Music Theater through March 16th. What is Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder all about?
It's definitely a very tongue-in-cheek, upper crust kind of comedy. It pays homage to sort of the operettas like Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah.
So it does have a feeling of sort of like that classical old style, but you know, it's about this young man's discovery of you know, a huge family fortune he's heir to that he didn't realize he was you know, in the family until recently, and then there are eight people ahead of him, and he slowly sort of whittles his way through the family to get to the front of succession.
Whittles is another way of saying kills. Yeah. And let me also just ask you this, Matt. Do you know why in the original design of the show, I mean, you're absolutely masterful in this. I guess it was always intended that your character would play so many roles. Yeah. Why? What was the original design of that? Do you know? I mean, they could have had nine people. I guess it saves on cast money.
I guess that. Yeah. I think that part of the charm is it's sort of this interesting kind of design. It's loosely based on Well, a book and also a subsequent movie. And in the movie, they used the same device. It was Alec Guinness who played the entire, I think it was Dascoigne, I think, in the movie. But, yeah, it's this, I think it's kind of a fun little addition to the convention of this story by having the same person play this family. I don't know that it would be as funny if it weren't, you know. I mean, there's that added element of comedy just by having, you know, one actor do it. It's a fun challenge, I'll tell you that.
I agree with you. And Andres, let me talk to you about, I mean, again, you play one role. We're making this as though everybody should play nine. But one great role. And talk to me about the little bit of, you've got, well, we know the murder part. Matt's given us that. Tell me about the love part.
Right. There are two main elements to this show, both murder and also love. Monty is, he, like Matt said, he's a gentleman who is a guy who starts out kind of living the life that he doesn't really want to be living. He's a little bit, he's poor, and he's been struggling, you know, his whole life, him and his mother, to make ends meet. And once he realizes that he's part of this fortune, he realizes he could possibly get everything that he wants, everything that he's ever wanted for him and his family. Which includes the love and affection of one of his longtime childhood friends, Sabella, who he's been in love with, you know, as long as he can remember.
Yeah.
And so he, part of his motivation in order to get everything that he wants and knock off all of these dice with is to finally be a man of stature enough that Sabella will recognize him as a suitable love interest, because she's one that is a little bit more interested in marrying for position and wealth rather than just true love.
Yeah,
she'd rather have the things, you know.
Right, and Andres, I will say we're having a little static in your line there, so just so you know, if you're someplace where you can maybe get an open line there. And Matt, actually, I want to go back to the nine roles, because here's what I thought you were going to say. My recollection is when this opened on Broadway, it starred Jefferson Mays, and Jefferson Mays, of course, the incredible actor from I Am My Own Wife and whatever, and I think he played many, many roles in that, as I saw him perform that years ago. So obviously, the casting of the show has to be really critical to get somebody with incredible skill variety. How much freedom did you get to sort of create each of these characters, as opposed to being directed to say, no, we know who each of these nine are. Here's what you need to be.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was given total freedom to play as much as I could in rehearsal. Stephen Schellhart was incredibly gracious in just kind of allowing me to figure out and, you know, change things constantly, because, you know, I typically I try to come in as memorized as possible and prepared to first day of rehearsal. But this was different. I'd never done anything quite like this. And it was very challenging and kind of scary, because I was like, I don't really know how to prepare for this show until we start rehearsals, because they are so out there. And I didn't want to have, you know, too much sort of preconceived before I saw, you know, was able to play with the rest of the cast. So it was a huge challenge, making them each distinct. You know, some of these characters are only in the show for like half a page, you know,
right.
So to try and find their isms, that would differentiate them, but, you know, still find the core of the comedy, in each scene. It was a lot of work, but, hugely, hugely gratifying to finally find, okay, that's who that guy is. All right, great, moving on, you know?
Right.
And I'm a huge Jefferson Mays fan, and I'm grateful that I had not seen the show with him in it. I did see him in My Own Wife. I Am My Own Wife. He's brilliant. And I think it was helpful to not have that sort of in my head for any, you know, character developments, because it's got to fit like a suit, you know. It's very tailor made, and it took a lot of mining and redefining and reevaluating, and we finally, you know, settled on who we have in this family.
I agree. I've always thought it's got to be tough. I mean, pick your show. Hello, Dolly. You know, you're Betty Buckley, and of course, you're Betty Buckley. But you know, you're walking in the steps of a Carol Channing or a Bette Midler, or you know, it's just. I always wonder how tough it is for somebody who steps into something that has been created in an iconic way, which would be your challenge here, Andres. For me, the role of Monty. I mean, we should hate him. He's murdering people. But the truth is, if we don't like him, then I think the show doesn't work. And I think we do like him. What is there? I just did an interview with the cast of Dear Evan Hansen. I kind of had the same critical thing. What Evan Hansen does isn't exactly great, but you got to like him for the show to work. Tell me why we like Monty.
Yeah, I think what you have to do, the tick with Monty is that you have to understand him before you see what he does. Which is, I think, you know, the way the show is written, I think that it does it fairly well, that you see him in squalor, you see him pining for, you know, Sibella's love, and you see him missing his mother, and you see that, all of that, and you're like, oh, I relate to that. I know what that's like. I know what loss is. I know what heartache is. And you see him kind of facing all of that as a gentleman, kind of taking it with grace, and then ultimately... His first encounter with the very first guy with, he gets the idea of murder, and you are completely on board with him because he's like, well, yeah, he's been putting up with so much stuff so far that we want you to do this, you know. So I think it has to come from the fact that Monty is so relatable and so very much that guy that you want to root for before he does anything terrible.
Yeah, and you do a great job of portraying that because it really is critical. And Matt, you know, this is an ensemble show. I mean, you guys are the leads, and there are, you know, some critical roles in this. But really, everybody on that stage, I think, commands attention. And again, partially direction, partially just the talent that Porchlight always casts. But I found myself during even all the ensemble numbers when everybody's out there, everybody has a character. There's nobody who's just sort of woman number three or man number two.
Oh yeah.
You get the feeling that everybody's got a role.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I think it's a solid, solid ensemble of very smart and unique actors who they're all putting their plenty of stamp on everything that they do on the periphery. So it doesn't get lost. You know, there's a tremendous amount of focus on detail in the ensemble, and so it is. It's a fully realized piece, and it's a tremendous amount of hard work and talent throughout the company. I mean, it really is. I mean, it makes all the difference in the world having an ensemble who really does take their responsibility to heart, and they find, you know, they find the missing pieces and detail and collect all that, and it really does. It makes a huge impact on the show as an entire piece.
You know, every time I review a Porchlight production, I always seem to have the comment, I didn't think they could do any better than the last one, and then they do. and I give Michael Weber a lot of that credit, but and maybe the one downfall was me hosting the New Faces of Broadway 1964 recently. Maybe that was a casting mistake. I don't know.
that was the beginning of the end.
The beginning of the end for Porchlight. No, actually, it was, well, we sold out. It was actually kind of a lot of fun. But anyway, let me ask you, because both of you guys, I know Matt is an artistic associate at Porchlight. You, Andres, have performed in several shows, Merrily We Roll Along, In the Heights. What is there? Can you identify what it is about a Porchlight Music Theater production that just always has it being outstanding, no matter who's directing, no matter who's doing their thing?
Yeah, I the reason I keep coming back to Porchlight for sure is it's provided me a lot of opportunities that I hadn't really had in my career before. You know, I was, for the long time, I was a dancer, and then sort of moved into the song and dance man territory, and I loved doing that. But Michael Weber really kind of showed me to some opportunities for you know, non-dancing comedic and dramatic roles in the musical theater canon. I think Porchlight to me is a place that really does pride itself in the work, in the attention to detail. It's not one of those big budget, you know, splashy houses. Yeah. And I admire that. You know, I think that there's, you can't hide, you know, sometimes shows kind of are hidden behind money. And you start to think, you know, it's not the work can be lost. And I think Porchlight is a very strong and creatively and artistically driven musical theater company that is always, you know, striving to grow artistically and makes quite a presence in Chicago. I mean, I really do think that they're being recognized more and more, and the work continues to get better. And then, you know, and it draws attention from actors who want to be involved in things like that. So, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of quality in the work that's being done there.
Yeah. Andres, let's try it again. We'll see if we can get a better connection on your answer to that. I know you're with
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, just like Verizon.
yeah.
You're with Lifeline Theater as well. Do you prefer to? What I love about Gentleman's Guide is it's a musical, but it's got that little dramatic piece to it. Do you like performing? You've done so many musicals, but do you prefer the musicals over straight plays?
I really don't. I used to prefer straight plays over musicals because I was, you know, I got my theater degree in acting, just straight acting, no music attachment to it. So I was so very, you know, hard set on doing dramatic roles and complex characters and such, and, you know, stuff that you find in the straight theater world. But the musical theater world is also so full of those kind of characters and such rich stories, you know, Gentleman's Guide included. So I don't necessarily have a preference anymore because I can find just as juicy and meaty and interesting and dynamic of a character in musicals as I can in a straight theater. And that's actually kind of a lot of the reason I do like keep going back to Porchlight to kind of piggyback off of what Matt was saying, is that Porchlight is a place that takes a little bit more of a risk with their show selection. They'll pick you know, something that you've heard before. Of course, they just did Gypsy and everything. Everyone knows right. Gypsy, but they, you know, it's such a rich story with such dynamic characters, and it's a lot of their work is character driven. You know, so I love going there to do the acting work. You know, it's not just about the spectacle. It's not just about the big flashy sets and the choreography. It's about the people on stage and the stories that they're telling, and that's what draws me to Porchlight, and that's what draws me to theater in general.
Whether it's Billy Elliot in The Heights, the Dreamgirls, I mean, the way they just fill a stage there and the power of the voices, it's one of the reasons I felt I should have been cast as Zach in the upcoming Chorus Line, but nobody else seemed to agree with that either.
well, that is a real shame.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you.
Yes.
You know what? And the next show you guys are in, refuse to perform. Just go in there and say no.
I think that's what we'll do. We'll actually boycott it.
Yeah. That'll go over well. Yeah.
I don't know whether to ask you a Dr. Doolittle question, Matt. But I'll do a positive one. Well, no, I've interviewed Tommy too, and he's great. But did you have fun on the tour? I think the tour lasted about a week. How was that? Was that fun?
It was one of my first big gigs after moving to New York. The show was it's where I met some of my very best friends still to this day.
Cool.
I had to tap dance next to Tommy Tune. We ran for about 9 months. Once he took it over. I mean, there was an ill-fated production of it that kind of closed on the road, and then they reinvented it and rewrote it and cut it down to a 90-minute show and you know, handed it over to Tommy Tune. I got to play some of the, you know, the Pantages, play some of the Fox theaters. I mean, it was cool just traveling around the country, tap dancing with Tommy Tune. I mean, it was a dream.
I know that was off topic, but you're the first person I've ever met who was in Dr. Doolittle. So I was a huge Dr. Doolittle fan. I read all the books. I mean, I'm totally about it. the original Doctor, not the Eddie Murphy stuff. I'm talking about Rex Harris and Samantha Eggar. I'm going back to Anthony Newley. Uh-huh. I'm going back to that one. I thought it was one of the great.
Oh, yeah.
Great of all time.
Yeah, and that was, you know, that was a lot of the music was from that. In fact, some of the they cut out a lot of ballads. So they tried to gear it more towards kids.
Oh, sure.
On the second, we called it Dr. Reed Doolittle, but it was I think it did pretty well, and it was the first time that Tommy Tune performed in over a decade.
Wow. Yeah, I did. I'm trying to think of the show that I interviewed him for. Not my one and only, because that was too long before. Anyway, something he recently did at the Goodman a few years ago.
Turn of the Century.
Thank you. Turn of the Century. That was it.
Turn of the Century, I think. Yeah.
That was it, which was so much fun. Oh, we should just chat for hours. Andres, let me ask you, what is, of course, with the Gentleman's Guide playing through the 16th, what's next on your agenda? I'm sure you have something coming soon.
There's a couple of projects. I don't think they've been officially announced, so I'm not quite sure if I can spoil them. But I'll be coming up in a couple of projects soon after Gentleman's Guide closes, and I'm really looking forward to it. There's some fantastic theaters in Chicago, and I get a chance. The next thing that I do, I will say that it is not a musical. It's actually going to be back into the straight play realm. And I'm very much looking forward to it.
Wow. Well, I'll be.
But I don't know. I don't know if I can spoil it right now because I think there needs to be an official announcement that hasn't come out yet.
This could be the official announcement if you think about it.
Officially announce it in my own hand.
Matt, what's coming up? You're one of the busiest men in show business. What's next up for you?
I'm kind of in the same boat right now as Andre. I'm still hammering out some details in a couple of contracts, but I've got a couple of things coming up. I have something this summer, it's one of those things where, you know, sort of before the contract's signed, I can't really go into it, but it's going to be a lot of fun. Keep your eyes open for it.
Well, look at the good news is you guys both have things you just can't tell me. I have nothing to tell you. So that's the difference. You guys are fantastic. Matt Crowell playing a million roles, and Andres Enriquez as Monty Navarro over at The Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder at the Porch Lights Theater. It's only through March 16th, so don't miss it. You can get tickets at porchlightmusictheater.org. I know, Andres, you were here at WGN performing on the midday show. Matt, were you here for that?
I was not, no.
Yeah, I thought it was just Andres. So I'm sorry, came in a little bit after that and I missed you. But you guys did great on the show, or you did great on the show, Andres. Have a fantastic run with the rest of the show through March 16th. Porchlight does nothing that isn't worth seeing. Everything is great. And this, without a doubt, is also fantastic. A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. Matt, Andres, thank you so much for your time with me, and break legs for the rest of the run.
Thanks, Paul. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you.
There seems to be a terrible curse on our family. Has it struck you what this means to you?
Sir, the possibility has always seemed so remote.
I should like to double your present salary and announce to the firm I have appointed you my successor.
My lord, there are no words. Only two people left still alive who stand between the earldom and me. Only two who survive who are still above me. On the Dicequith family tree is the next one. My employer, Asquith Dicequith, but he's treated me so well, how ungrateful to remove him after all his kindness.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.